This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're joined by Cassandra Alexander. She's an ICU nurse in Oakland, California. Hi there, Cassandra.
Hi.
So it's been 20 long months. 20. It's kind of hard to believe, but 20 long months since COVID was first declared a global pandemic. And I know there have been many tough moments for you over those 20 months, Cassandra, but what was your toughest moment so far?
Yeah, so the one I've needed the most therapy for, and that's kind of like a trauma laugh there, because if you don't laugh about things, you realize that you've kind of lost a piece of your soul sometimes. Came last winter when I was taking care of a member of a family who had not wanted to participate in the holidays, and they were overruled. And unfortunately, at their holiday gathering, they and many other members of their family got sick with COVID. So I took care of them on and off for 6 weeks, I think, all the while their condition deteriorating, and all of us, at least on the hospital side, knowing that they weren't going to make it. You know, you tell family members that recovery is unlikely, but everybody keeps hoping and hoping and hoping for a miracle. And, you know, we inside the hospital know that miracles are few and far between. And at the end, the day that they were going to pass, they were my patient. And so I called the family and told them that they needed to get in if they wanted to see them while they were alive. And so in my efforts to keep them alive for that to be able to happen, their lungs had deteriorated so much so that our ventilators weren't able to actually provide enough force to kind of press the air into the lung tissue and then hopefully have it circulate to some degree. I mean, honestly, at that point, they were kind of alive in name only. They were actively dying, as we call it, which sounds technical, but it's true. There was nothing that I or anyone else could have done to change the course of events at that time. Mm-hmm. Not that we still didn't want to, and not that we still weren't giving it our all, but there was just nothing that we could do. And so I was bagging the patient with one of those bags people have probably seen on TV, because, again, I needed to provide more force than the ventilator could to attempt to oxygenate them just long enough for their family to visit. And then their family got there, and they were obviously so distressed and so dismayed. And, you know, praying for a miracle that I knew would never happen. I mean, it was impossible. Mm-hmm. There was no lung tissue left. It was just me animating a corpse to some degree, which is tragic but true. And
I'm sorry to jump in here, Cassie, yeah. But just to be clear, because it's a very arresting thing that you just said, but it's true that because you were physically, like, with your own hand squeezing the bag, right, to ventilate this person, that was the only thing keeping them technically alive.
Yeah. You know, and alive should be in air quotes there, unfortunately. Mm. And the second I stopped, they were going to die. And that's what happened. And, you know, I had blisters the next day where my nails weren't cut short enough. So I had blisters on the tips of my fingers from having bagged that person for so long.
How long was it?
It's funny. I've decided now in my head that it's 40 minutes, but I talked to all my coworkers and they're all like, remember when you bagged that guy for 2 hours? So the truth is probably somewhere in between there. But yeah, longer than I had ever bagged anybody before, because, you know, usually determinations are made. But but honestly, this wasn't a code situation because there was nothing that we could do. We can't replace lost lung tissue, right? So this is kind of in a situation where it was okay to go above and beyond in this one arena because I was just trying to keep them alive long enough for their family to say goodbye before he was technically dead, basically. And then the family rolling in and not fully gathering where we were at, no matter how often we had explained to them the direness of their loved one's circumstance, because no one wants to be confronted with death. And then also, too, no one wants to have any part in being responsible for death. And to some degree, the fact that they had had the holiday gathering was what had killed them. Mm. So, you know, they obviously just kept hoping for an outcome that was impossible. And so their grief at the bedside was so painfully intense. And I'm like an empathic person. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I became a nurse, is so I could help people. And so, you know, not being able to help them in their time of need, help, not being able to even give them a hug, because that's what I would normally do with crying family members, is I would hug them in an instant. It was awful. And then several months later, they called our palliative care team and they talked to me because they had asked if everything had been done. And I get that as a family, they have a right to ask that and why that would be a concern to them. But that just felt like a secondary blow. I almost cried there at work that day.
Oh, they asked or questioned if everything possible had been done to keep that person alive.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, and the palliative care doctor wasn't asking me that because we all knew that I had gone above and beyond, and there was nothing that could have been done unless God himself decided to resurrect him, basically.
Mm. Well, let me just step in here for a second, if I can, Cassandra, because that's quite an experience that you just shared with us, and it's just one, right, of many, I presume, that you've had over the past 20 months. And the reason why we're talking to you today is that folks may have started to hear this statistic that's been coming out, that 1 in 5 healthcare workers in the United States have left the profession since February of 2020. Another 30% have considered or are considered leaving. So the system was under strain already, but now it's this is a whole new kind of crisis in healthcare. And we want to get sort of the inside view of why this is happening. So the other note that I should make is that Cassandra Alexander is actually a pseudonym that you're using because we don't want you to get in trouble with your hospital. So that's understandable. But Cassandra's also written a book called Year of the Nurse, a 2020 COVID-19 pandemic memoir. But so let me ask you, that's just one experience that you shared?
That's just one out of a panoply. There's so many, Meghna. And I'm not alone. I always try to impress upon people, every nurse in America who went through COVID last year has experiences like that that haunt them, whether or not they realize that those hauntings are side product of the PTSD that I am absolutely sure that all of us carry with us right now. We all were in the same boiling pot, slowly getting boiled together.
Well, I mean, there was a point where I think you sent a message to some of your friends one day.
And you said...
Yeah, you want to tell us what that message said?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's one of the luxuries of having a pseudonym, is that it kind of allows me to be free. And I really want other nurses to know that they're not alone out there in their experiences. So on April 25th in the morning, I sent my girls chat a note. I was at work and I was like, it's pretty ironic that I'm here trying to keep people alive when all I want to do is die. and they kind of alerted my squad and got a hold of my husband, and I talked to my charge nurse, and I got to leave work early that day because I had started crying, and I didn't stop crying probably for 3 to 4 weeks. Like, I just had reached the maximum of emotional strain that I could even begin to cope with. And luckily, I was able to get in with my therapist and start treatment immediately. And I did get to take some time off for psych reasons. But yeah, I had never had PTSD before my job. And while I did suffer occasionally from anxiety and depression, I had never had such vibrant suicidal ideation as being a COVID nurse.
Wow. Well, so we'll talk about the fact that you were able to get help in a little bit, Cassie. But now, I mean, you're back at work now. Are you one of those now 30% who are thinking about leaving the profession?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, basically, if you offered every healthcare worker in America a job that paid equivalently as well as their job that they currently have, they would leave. Like, there's nobody who's super interested in sticking around and being a nurse anymore. And I say that with some sense of shame, because that's like, you know, we all became nurses and other healthcare professionals so that we could help people. But now we're just so ground down by the system that that doesn't have any real meaning for us anymore. So yeah, but one of the things though is, and that's also why you see so many people leaving to take traveler positions, because they think, oh, you know, if I'm just going to get injured no matter where I go, I might as well cash out. But, what I've found from talking to friends, who've changed hospitals recently is that right now, if I can impress anything upon your people, it's that there are no life rafts. Each hospital is just its own differently sinking ship.
Well, Cassandra, hang on here for just a second.
Sure.
We're talking today about the number of healthcare professionals who have left healthcare, 1 in 5 already since last year, and how many more are considering leaving, why that's happening, and what we can do about it. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the fact that since the start of the pandemic, 1 in 5 American healthcare workers have left the profession. Another 30% are thinking about it right now. And we're, of course, trying to explore the reasons why, not just the pandemic, but what the pandemic has revealed about the underlying precariousness of healthcare in America. And also talking about the impact it's having not only on those very healthcare workers, but on all of us across this country as the people who rely on that very system. So let's listen to some On Point listeners who called us. This is Jennifer from Charleston, Maine. She switched out of healthcare because she found she did not have the tools she needed to do her job.
I left my work as a substance use counselor and a mental health caseworker because it was exhausting, having to never have enough resources to meet even the most minimum needs for safety and health of my clients. So I left the field and have taken a job which is not my calling or my passion, but feels safer.
That's Jennifer in Charleston, Maine. This is Summer, a labor and delivery nurse in Kirkland, Washington.
We are chronically understaffed. We are taking unsafe patient loads. We don't get our break. The pay has not changed. We don't get paid that well. You know, our benefit packages are getting reduced every year. Very strict PTO and sick time rule. I've only been a nurse for 4 years, so almost half of my career has been during a pandemic. I'm exhausted. I'm overwhelmed. I'm going back to school to get my master's degree because I can't and won't continue to be a martyr at the bedside, and I'm not alone.
That's Summer, a labor and delivery nurse who listens to On Point from Kirkland, Washington. I'm joined today by Cassandra Alexander. She's an ICU nurse in Oakland, California, author of the memoir Year of the Nurse, a 2020 COVID-19 pandemic memoir. And joining us now is Dr. Wendy Dean. She's co-founder of the Moral Injury of Healthcare, a nonprofit organization that provides training and consultation to organizations. They're focused on alleviating distress in their workforce. She also has 15 years of experience as an emergency room physician. Dr. Dean, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Magnet. It's good to be here with you.
I wonder what you think of that last sentence that Summer, the On Point listener, the nurse in Kirkland, Washington, what she said, "I can't and won't continue to be a martyr at the bedside." How did that land with you?
I think it's very accurate. So we need to remember that the distress in healthcare didn't start with the pandemic. This has been going on for 20 years. It has been a constant battle with our healthcare workforce to get the supplies and the staffing and the space that they need to do their work. The pandemic has made it worse. It's intensified it, but it didn't start it. And that distress won't end when the pandemic ends.
Mm. It's sort of revealed it, let's put it that way, and brought it into extremely sharp relief because, you know, you're right. It didn't start it, but it has put, you know, previously unseen pressures, I would say, on people like Cassie. So what did you hear from, and Cassie, I'll come back to you in a second, but what did you, Dr. Dean, what did you hear from her story, you know, when she talked about the psychological distress she was experiencing, just trying to keep people functionally alive as family members wept at their bedside trying to say goodbye?
I heard what I've heard 100 times, 1,000 times in the clinicians that we work with every day. This is a story that has repeated 700,000 times with the 700,000 deaths that we've had. Every one of them has been attended by at least one healthcare worker, probably multiple. And so that is an experience that is widespread, and it is causing our workforce to break. I heard a physician say the other day, "I don't know what else I can say to people to help them understand how hard this is. I don't know how much longer I can do it."
Cassie, can I turn back to you for a second? Because you are an ICU nurse. So even in pre-pandemic times, when people ended up in the ICU, they weren't in the best of condition, to put it mildly. But had you seen as much death before the pandemic as you did in the
sorry to jump in.
No, please go ahead.
That's the nurse in me. And prior to being an ICU nurse, I was a burn nurse for 10 years. Mm. So I have seen things. But no. I mean, because nobody becomes a healthcare worker because they want to watch people die. You know, we're just aware that sometimes, given the situation, you might have a harder go of keeping them alive. Like in the ICU, you have to try harder. But it was so demoralizing, just so demoralizing and so unreal. And, you know, one of the things that caused that too was that we weren't allowed to have visitation, which was good from a public health standpoint. We didn't want visitors there. But because families weren't bedside with us, they weren't able to see how hard we were trying to keep their loved ones alive, because a lot of times in pre-COVID times, that would be what would trigger the heavy conversation, or they would finally understand why we wanted to discuss goals of care with them, because they would say, "Gosh, there's so many people in this room. My loved one's connected to so many machines. I don't think this is what they would want anymore." But because COVID came and we weren't allowed to have visitors, and it struck people of all ages and made them really ill, because nobody wants to have goals of care conversations with somebody who's in their 40s, And it surprised everybody. It came out of nowhere and it made it harder for people to let their loved ones pass. And so we were just trapped kind of in a purgatory, taking care of patients almost in this deck chairs on the Titanic situation where we knew they weren't going to live, but their families wouldn't let them die. And that was bad, yeah. Very bad.
Well, Dr. Dean, I mean, Cassie's describing a situation of knowing of being surrounded not only by death, but by futility, right? Because as you just said, they knew that their patients were going to die. The disruption of the sort of normal psychological practices around those moments and also just lack of support as well. So what you've really focused on and your organization is named after this is the fact that these things in combination create what you call a moral injury, which is different than burnout. So when you say moral injury in healthcare, what does that mean?
So what that means is every healthcare worker in some way, shape, or form takes an oath to put their patients as a priority. And what we're finding is that the way healthcare is structured, and particularly with the constraints of the pandemic, that structure does not allow healthcare workers to practice as they were trained to do. They're not allowed to, they can't get their patients the care that they need. And when that happens, it's intensely frustrating, but it also undermines that promise that they made to society that they would be there to take care of them. And when you're faced with that day in and day out, you start to wonder on some level, am I really the person I thought I was? And that's what undermines and underlies this sense of moral injury.
Cassandra, did you ever ask yourself that question?
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, I was so proud of the work that I did as an ICU nurse for sure. And when I was a burn nurse though, particularly, you know, I viewed myself as like the toughest of the tough. And, you know, it's really easy for people in the outside world to say, oh, you're not your job. But I had made it a huge part of who I was. And then to discover that part of me was broken, and then to go on and think, you know, after I had my crisis that I may not get to be that person anymore. It was very devastating. Mm-hmm. And now I've had to draw a very hard line between leaving work at work and understanding that I am not my job, even though me and nurse being synonymous, I used to derive a lot of satisfaction from that, but it's not safe for me to feel like that mm-hmm. right now anymore.
Well, Dr. Dean, we've heard time and again that many people who enter healthcare do so not because they're seeking a vocation, but because, I mean, as Cassie has said, as some of the callers who left us messages have said, it's a calling, right? I mean, it's sort of it's morally driven from the start. And so I wonder, though, even with that truth, that profound truth, I mean, you have 15 years of experience in an ER. There have even before the pandemic been situations where someone like Cassie, maybe you, as you saw in the emergency department, wished that you could have done more, but simply couldn't because the system didn't allow it or wasn't set up to save that particular life. What's different now? Because I would think that hopefully healthcare workers, as they, like the rest of us, understood that this was a once-in-a-century experience that we were all collectively going through as planet Earth, would say, well, if any time I can't save a life and it's a forgivable lapse, if I can call it that, it's now. Do you know what I mean? Like the forgiveness should have been built in. The self-forgiveness could have been built in from the start.
So I think there is some of that. We all recognize that in certain situations, there is a futility to what mm-hmm. we're doing. But I think the challenge for a lot of healthcare workers in the pandemic has been that the messages that are coming from elsewhere have been sort of hamstringing our ability to do our job. So the betrayal that we felt from our state or our federal leadership that was encouraging mask resistance or vaccine resistance, that didn't allow us to prevent some of what we were seeing. The supply chains that we relied on so heavily, instead of having stockpiles of PPE or other supplies, we relied on supply chains. Not having those supply chains available, we know they reliably fail in a crisis, meant that we couldn't do our jobs, even though we had been saying over and over again, we need to prepare. We see this coming. We need to be ready. And the system just couldn't catch up with where we needed to be. And I think knowing, being able to predict what's coming and not being able to stop it has been the hardest thing that I've heard from most clinicians.
Hmm. How are there similarities between the kind of moral injury you're describing amongst healthcare workers and, say, what we've seen, you know, members of the military experience, where they may come back from a tour of duty and having seen a lot of terrible things, also on top of that question why they were even there to begin with. So they wonder about the moral justification of the sacrifice they and their fellow members of the military were asked to make, because we know that that has a terrible psychological cost. Is it similar?
This is part of the reason why my co-author, Simon Talbot, and I wrote about moral injury in healthcare. I had been working with the Army for almost a decade, and had seen similarities in the service members who were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan and some of the struggles that they had. And we were talking about our dissatisfaction with the concept of burnout, which implies an individual frailty. And what we were hearing from our colleagues was that it wasn't an individual frailty, it was the system preventing them from doing their jobs that was the problem. And it felt very similar to me, although in a very different context, to what service members coming back had experienced.
Mm. Well, we only have Cassie for a couple of more minutes. So, Dr. Dean, actually, I'm wondering if you would like to just like turn to Cassie, because she's still going into work at the ICU every day. Do you have any advice for her, or any words to share for her as she, you know, is going to go back to work today or tomorrow?
Yeah. So I think one of the most important things to know is she's not alone. That there are plenty of others who are out there who understand her position. That there are people she can reach to. Our organization is there. And that setting her boundaries is the best way to start with self-care.
And Cassie, we've got you just for a couple more minutes. Would love to hear more of what you'd like to say and sort of what you think as you go into work every day now.
I just wanted to hop back to your war metaphor, if particularly apt. The kind of therapy that my therapist did with me to help me get through the worst of my PTSD was EMDR therapy, which is the same type of therapy that they do for combat veterans. And over the course of going through very extensive therapy, I would agree with Dr. Dean. I now realize that I am not my job and I need to definitely maintain those strong boundaries, but I also have to find job satisfaction in the effort that I put into my job. And I can't count on the outcomes anymore, at least not where COVID patients are. So I just have to accept that I am trying my hardest, but it is okay if I don't have good outcomes, because by and large, that's not my fault. It's not things or decisions that I did that they're going to end up in this person doing poorly. You know, I guess in a way, just not to take it so personally anymore.
You said you have to accept that. Have you accepted it yet?
It's a journey. So yeah, we'll see as this winter continues and how rough it gets. So,
Well, Cassandra Alexander, an ICU nurse in Oakland, California, and author of Year of the Nurse, a 2020 COVID-19 pandemic memoir. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Wendy Dean, stand by. When we come back, we're going to talk about really how this is having an impact on all of us, because we're all patients that rely on this healthcare system, and what we need to do in order to help fix it, to help the people whose job is to help us. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about the fact that since the pandemic began last year, one in five American healthcare workers have left their jobs. Another 30% have thought about it or are thinking about it. So obviously, we need to take a look at the impact this is having, not just on those workers in healthcare, but on all of us as the patients that rely on that very system. And we're getting a lot of feedback from listeners here. For example, ZJ Mayan says, as a nurse practitioner, this conversation is so validating. It's not only COVID patients. I'm in primary care and I've never encountered so much hostility as I do now. Patients no longer trust me. That's a huge problem. Ann Trollinger says, if I could quit, I would. And Sean Lowry says, even despite the high wages for traveling respiratory therapists, I refuse to go back and take care of patients that cannot simply get vaccinated against COVID when they have received over 50 vaccinations already in their lifetimes, I believe. And Jill says the future of nursing is travel nursing. That's been one of the most interesting developments during the pandemic. Well, here's Megan, an On Point listener who's a registered nurse from Buffalo, New York, and here's what she told us.
I just gave my notice 2 days ago, 2 weeks' notice. I'm quitting my hospital nurse job, and I took a travel nurse assignment, which is what hundreds of other people that I know are doing because they're actually paying nurses what they deserve and giving them the experience that they need and supporting them all at the same time.
I'm joined today by Dr. Wendy Dean. She's co-founder of The Moral Injury of Healthcare, a nonprofit that provides training and consultation for alleviating distress in the healthcare workforce. And Dr. Dean, we want to expand sort of the scope of this conversation now, but to the healthcare system overall. But just remark, if you will, about this travel nursing, the growth in travel nursing that we've been seeing here. I completely understand how getting paid more for the willingness to move around may counteract some of the kinds of psychological injuries we've been talking about. But can it fully counterbalance the fundamental moral injuries that you've been discussing with us?
So I think what was really interesting about what that caller said was her last sentence, that she is getting paid more, but also that she's being treated differently. And I think this is the thing that I've heard and that my organization has heard over and over again. It's not necessarily about just the money. It's also about people having their backs. Mm-hmm. It's about their leadership allowing them to speak up about the trouble that they're having. It's about being able to talk to the community and ask them, to participate in prevention. It's all of those things. It's not simply about the money. Although I do think that a lot of clinicians, not just nurses, are hoping that moving to another location or multiple locations will help them to find a place that's doing things differently and where it's better.
Okay. So in just a minute or two, we're going to talk with the leader of a healthcare system in California. But we have been mentioning nurses a lot. Of course, when we say the number of people who've left healthcare, that one in five, it includes physicians as well. And here's one.
So I'm Justin Meschler. I am, or I guess you could say I was, an anesthesiologist.
Was. Interesting. Well, Dr. Meschler lives in Colorado, and he practiced anesthesiology for about 15 years. At the beginning of his career, he says everything was great. But as time went on, he noticed how multi-million-dollar corporations kept buying up the private practice groups he worked at. And this was before the pandemic. And after those purchases, he says things did not run as smoothly as before.
So at first I thought, oh, you know, I'll give it a try. I'll, you know, see how it goes. But ran into so many weird ways in which the group was being managed by somebody. Honestly, the manager was oftentimes living in another state. You'd see them once a year. And they would do silly things like tell us we had to schedule our shifts this way or that way. And then, you know, you tell them, well, if you schedule us that way, people are going to start leaving. And they do it anyway. And then people start leaving the group.
Before the pandemic, Meschler had already been thinking of jumping from anesthesiology to pain management or psychiatry. But then COVID arrived, and he found himself in situations that he felt wholly unprepared for and unsupported. At the hospital where he worked last year, for example, there were no protocols for how to safely intubate a suspected COVID patient. So he and his colleagues wrote their own protocol. Now, I will say that that might not be so unusual in the first days of a once-in-a-century pandemic. However, Meschler also told us the hospital was unprepared in other more fundamental ways. For example, they provided spacesuit-style protective gear, but when Meschler asked for instructions on how to use that gear, no one responded.
So Sunday rolled around that week, and I happened to be on call, and I got a call that there was a patient with a high fever with suspected COVID, and they needed to go to the operating room. I really freaked out because I had no idea how to use the protective equipment. I was going to be the first person to actually do this protocol that we wrote on how to most safely put a breathing tube in the patient and do the surgery and then take the breathing tube out as soon as possible. And I think I told you before, that was my last day as a doctor. I became so scared and frustrated that are not only my safety, but the safety of the people all around me who I worked with was not being taken as seriously as I thought it should have been.
Justin Meschler left working as an anesthesiologist in early April 2020, and he says he may not have left his hospital system had it been more prepared and concerned about the health and safety of its employees. And Dr. Meschler says he now feels a mixture of guilt and relief, but as time goes on, he says, the relief is winning out. Well, joining us now from Los Angeles is Dr. Elaine Batchelor. She's the chief executive officer of the MLK Community Healthcare System. The system she leads includes Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital. Dr. Batchelor, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
So first of all, just quickly tell me, how has this sort of exodus of healthcare workers, has that had an impact on your hospital and system?
Yes, well, it has had some impact on our hospital. We are a little different from some of these other places that we've been hearing about because our health system serves a community that was in a crisis before the pandemic even came along. And we have been dealing with a lack of resources in our community since the beginning. That being said, the pandemic has been an unprecedented strain on our health system and on the community. And we have seen an increase in the number of nurses in particular who are taking leaves of absence. We haven't had a mass exodus, though.
Okay. You know, well, I think, first of all, that's good to hear that perhaps the impact is not yet what what it's been in other places. But as Dr. Dean and others have been saying, and Dr. Batchel, I know you're fully aware of this, let's talk a little bit more about what's been revealed, right? Because it seems like what's underneath all of this is that there is, you know, the United States still kind of stands relatively alone in the fact that healthcare is a for-profit business in this country overall. And that a for-profit business has people who are really good at the business part. It has people who are really good in the actual delivery of healthcare part. But those two things did not come together in the way they needed to in the midst of a once-in-a-century pandemic. I mean, is that part of what's caused this undue psychological burden on healthcare workers themselves?
I think that is part of it, but it's not just due to the pandemic. It's been going on for many years. And our community that we serve here in South Los Angeles is an example of how the way that we fund healthcare and the profit motive can leave entire communities bereft of the healthcare they need. We serve a low-income community that's primarily African-American and Latino. And because it's primarily insured through Medicaid, and Medicaid pays very low payment rates for healthcare, the community is missing 1,300 doctors and has the fewest number of hospital beds in the county. So you can see how the profit motive and the lack of funding is hurting a community like this. I think we need to recognize that healthcare is a necessity and a public good as much as clean water, electricity, and roads. And we need to treat it in a similar manner.
Mm. I get the sense, Dr. Batchel, that you're very graciously trying to refrain from saying, it's about time we started talking about this much more seriously. Why were we waiting for a pandemic, right?
I'm grateful that the pandemic is getting us talking about the right issues.
Okay, well, so about the actual healthcare workers whom patients rely on here. I know this is something you've thought about a lot. Like, what can be done right now, for example, to better support them?
Well, I think that we heard from the previous doctor that healthcare workers are in it to serve people. They're usually mission driven, and what they need is adequate staffing, supplies, and space. And they need a system that is designed to support health in the community. We need to strengthen the public health system so that we can do a better job of managing and containing pandemics. And we need to invest in community-based healthcare so that we have a population that is healthy, that's engaging in prevention, and that is going to be partnering with our healthcare workers to maintain their health.
Mm. Dr. Dean, what do you say to that? We've got a comment here from Andrew Heath on Facebook who says, tell the owners of hospitals across the nation to stop making billions of dollars off the lives of humans.
So I have a huge smile on my face listening to Dr. Batchelor because I absolutely agree with her. I think one of the ways that we can help healthcare workers is to support them in taking care of the patients that they know are underrepresented or in communities that are struggling. We know that they are at risk. And this holds not just for physical health, but for mental health as well. We need to look at how we fund healthcare and how we can restructure it to get care to the people who need it.
Tell me more. Specifically, I mean, look, that's a huge, I'll grant that that's a huge thing, okay?
I can give you two simple examples, okay? One is that these communities, these underserved communities of color and low-income communities are insured by a public program called Medicaid that in many places pays pennies on the dollar compared to Medicare and commercial insurance. And that inequity is leaving these communities without the doctors, the healthcare facilities, the urgent cares, the pharmacies that they need. Second example would be the way that we use a lot of our funding in hospitals instead of going upstream and investing in community-based prevention and disease management, which would would prevent people from getting sick enough to end up in hospitals. So our funding priorities are upside down.
Huh. Dr. Dean, did you want to comment on that?
I couldn't say it better. Okay. I think that was perfect.
And what about sort of further upstream, Dr. Batchelor, right? I mean, there's Medicaid reimbursement. There's the support that can be given, you know, on the front line in clinics and hospitals. Are there places that we should look further upstream in terms of, I don't know if it's funding or the way that residency programs are structured to get healthcare workers in places like you're saying that need it the most? Should we be thinking more creatively, essentially?
We absolutely should be thinking more creatively. We need to diversify our workforce to reflect the diversification of our country's population. We know that we have an aging workforce and an aging population that will need more healthcare. And we need to make it easier for young people to study medicine and nursing. Money should not be a barrier to someone who wants to become a doctor or a nurse and serve humanity. And the way that we structure medical education and training right now, the average medical student graduates with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And once they have taken on that debt, ironically, even if they are a person of color who wants to work in an underserved community, they can no longer afford to work in an underfunded community that relies on Medicaid. So we do need to change how we fund medical education and nursing education, and we need to get a more robust pipeline that reflects our population. Mm.
You know, we've just got about a minute and a half left, and I want to circle back to the truth of what one in five healthcare workers leaving actually means. Because here's just a little quick anecdote that I had a very close friend recently who needed some rather urgent care and couldn't get it in the state that he was in because A, there were a lot of elective surgeries that were happening. B, there were a lot of COVID patients taking up hospital beds. And C, there wasn't enough staff in any of the hospitals in his state. So he had to actually take an ambulance trip to another state to get a bed. So that's just one example. And I think to myself, and Dr. Dean, I'll turn to you on this. In any other organization, if you had heard that one in five of their workers had left and another third were thinking about it, you'd say that organization was on the verge of collapse. I mean, is that too strong a word to put on American healthcare right now?
I'm worried about it. And I think for too long, we have taken it for granted that it would always, that the best care in the world would always be there whenever we needed it, wherever we needed it. And we have pushed our system to the very brink.
Well, Dr. Wendy Dean is co-founder of the Moral Injury of Healthcare, a nonprofit organization that focuses on alleviating distress in the healthcare workforce, also practiced for 15 years as an emergency room physician. Dr. Dean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Dr. Elaine Batchelor, CEO of the MLK Community Healthcare System, including the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital in Los Angeles. Dr. Batchelor, thank you so much for coming back to On Point.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.